Thanks. So this is the second lecture on the basics of quantum information and computation. Yesterday morning, Patrick Hayden talked about quantum states, quantum channels, various things having to do with distinguishability of quantum states. In this lecture, I'm going to focus on a rather different aspect of quantum information, which is its use for computation. We have some computational problem of interest and we would like to solve it and use quantum information to help us to do that. And in particular, my main goal is to explain Shor's algorithm for factoring integers with a quantum computer. I can't speak to the relevance or importance of this problem to high energy physics or quantum gravity. I'll leave that to others to try to explain, but certainly it's difficult to overstate the importance of this algorithm for quantum computing. It really is more than just an example. It's the crown jewel of quantum algorithms and really is responsible for a lot of the interest that has developed over the past 20 years since it's been discovered. I will jump right in. I should say, of course, feel free to ask questions at any time. Just stop me. I'm quite happy to answer questions if I can. In the first part of the talk, I'm going to be talking about the integer factoring problem. It's a good example of a problem so that I can say more general things having to do with computational efficiency, computational hardness. I'll also talk a little bit about the quantum circuit model. And the relationship of quantum circuits to classical circuits, which is not difficult, but it's important that we take note of this. So let me begin with integer factoring. So it is the case that if you have a positive integer that's at least 2, then you can express that positive integer as a product of prime numbers, and there's only one way that you can do it up to the ordering of the prime factors. For example, not a very impressive example to start with. 15 is equal to 3 times 5. Of course, that's the only way that you can express 15 as a product of primes. Whoops, I'm having a little trouble with my clicker here. 198 looks like this. 2 times 3 times 3 times 11. So sometimes you can have a prime that's repeated. That's necessary sometimes. Here's a larger example that illustrates perhaps something about this problem that you don't see from these simple examples here. This is a number. It has a name. It's called RSA 768. It is 768 binary digits, which is 232, I believe, decimal digits. And it looks like the product of these two relatively large primes here. I'm going to have to do something about this clicker here. So what the integer factoring problem is that you are given a positive integer bigger than or equal to 2. And let's say that you are given that integer expressed in binary notation. And your job is to try to figure out what are the prime factors of that number. You want to express those in binary notation. If you prefer to do it in decimal notation like it is on this slide here, that's an equivalent problem. Converting from binary to decimal is very, very simple computational process. But actually finding the factors, the prime factors of a number is a very difficult computational process, as far as we know. So I guess that perhaps it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that if we have a computational problem and we want to solve it, it's obviously not enough for us to have an algorithm that solves that problem. We need our algorithm to be an efficient algorithm. For example, even I can come up with a factoring algorithm. And here it is right here. So you are given a positive integer n and you'd like to factor it. Well, you just set up a loop starting from 2 and you go up to n and you test to see if that number divides the number you're given. And if it does, then you output that number and you stop. That'll give you the smallest prime factor. And now you can just recurse on whatever you had if you divided that prime out of the number. And you can continue like this. Well, that's a perfectly fine algorithm and it's a, you know, perhaps is a very efficient algorithm in the sense that it only took me these two short lines to write it, but that's not the way we measure efficiency, of course. We're much more interested in how many steps it takes and how long it takes. if we want to analyze the running time of this algorithm, that's easy to do. So you see that we have this loop here, and this loop is happening roughly n times. Perhaps it's less, but in the worst case, it's about n times. And something is happening inside of the loop. We're testing this division here. And if you do an analysis and you have a straightforward way of testing if a number divides another number, then the running time will look something like this. So this is big O of n times log n squared. So log n squared is roughly the number of steps it takes to do this trial division, and the loop is running n times. And I'm going to assume that people are familiar with this big O notation, but in case you're not, it just means we're throwing away constant factors, we're throwing away lower order terms, and we're just looking at the asymptotic growth as a function of n, where we're ignoring any leading constant, just to get a rough estimate of how long this is taking. I may give up on this clicker. Now, the problem with this algorithm is that this running time here is exponential. It's exponential in input length. The length of the input was the binary description of the number. That's about log n bits, give or take. And so you see that we have this n here. So this means this is exponential in log n. It's an exponential time algorithm. And if you were to try to use this algorithm, of course, you could use it and you could factor 15, or you could factor whatever that other number was. What was it, 198 or something? That would work fine. But obviously, it wouldn't work for the third example I gave you. If you were to take something like a 1,000-bit prime number, and it happened to be that there was no small prime factors of that number, you could reasonably expect this algorithm to run longer than the age of the universe on the fastest computer in the world. In fact, all of them working together, dividing up the interval and testing these numbers would never finish. It's a useless algorithm. So we would like to have something faster than that. So of course, if I give you a bad algorithm for some problem, like the one from the previous slide, it doesn't tell you that you can't do it better, obviously. And it is possible to factor integers more efficiently with a classical computer. The fastest known algorithm is called the number field sieve, and it has a running time that looks something like this. So C is some constant, and I don't know what the constant is, but other people know. Maybe it's 10, or maybe it's 3, who knows. And it is exponential because you have the log n and the exponent, but you have a 1/3 here, so you are getting a pretty significant savings over this kind of brute force, just testing all the possibilities. That is the best known classical algorithm. And I should just highlight that it is the case that there is no polynomial time algorithm that is known. And what a polynomial time algorithm would look like would be a running time, which is the length of the input raised to some fixed power, like C could be 2 or 3, or it could be a billion. But something that's fixed that doesn't grow as the input size grows. We would consider this to be a polynomial time algorithm, and we don't have any such algorithm for factoring. On the other hand, nobody can prove that there does not exist a classical polynomial time algorithm for factoring. This is an example of a more general phenomenon that we just don't know how to prove impossibility results for most computational problems of interest. There's just no techniques that are known that rule out the existence of some very clever algorithm that somebody in the distant future or somebody on a different planet could discover. Maybe there is such an algorithm for factoring. We haven't found it, but it could exist. So this number field sieve algorithm is pretty impressive. The example that I gave you from the previous slide, RSA 768, this is an example of a number that was factored using the number field sieve. So this was one of these numbers that RSA Laboratories published. They used to offer cash prizes if people could factor the numbers. They stopped giving the cash prizes about 10 years ago or so. And that number was factored, I think it was in 2009. So it was factored after the cash prize was no longer available, but I don't think people were in it for the money. They were in it for the glory of factoring these numbers. Of course, the difficulty, or the security of the RSA crypto system is based on the difficulty of factoring, in the sense that if you can factor efficiently, then you can break the RSA crypto system. So obviously, RSA Laboratories has an interest in understanding limitations on factoring. The way that that particular number was factored using the number field sieve, it involved a team of people using computers around the world to run this algorithm in a distributed fashion. And I think that an estimate for the CPU time was something like 2,000 years of CPU time went into factoring that number. So that gives you a sense for the computational difficulty of factoring. If we were to double the size of the number in the sense that we're doubling the number of digits, that would be a completely impossible problem with our current technology using this algorithm. Question? Okay, so the question is, are we interested in the worst case, looking at the product of two primes? It may not necessarily be the case that the product of two primes is the worst case, but that is a typical problem of interest with respect to the RSA crypto system, because the way that system works is you start by choosing two large primes, multiplying them together, and then that becomes the public key that everybody knows, but only the person who is going to decrypt knows the factorization. We are typically interested in the worst case to analyze algorithms. But in the case of RSA, you certainly would be interested in a sort of average case. You wouldn't want to accidentally pick two large primes, multiply them together, and it turned out to be very easy to factor that number. For example, if you took the same prime and you multiplied it to itself, this would be easy to factor. You can just compute the square root and see that you have this number. So you would want some sort of average case hardness, but for the sake of simplicity here, we're just talking about the worst case. 768. The question was, I'm supposed to say the questions because the live stream doesn't pick up. The question is, how many bits did that number have? And you can look these up if you just do search for RSA. If you do search for RSA 768 or RSA challenge number, you will find a list of them. There's quite a lot of them that are not factored yet that are larger than that. Okay, so the question is, because factoring is in co-NP, and implicitly you're suggesting it's not NP-complete, what is the conventional wisdom about its difficulty? Is it likely to eventually be shown to be in P? I think you would get two different opinions if you asked two different people about that. You might even get three. Probably most people conjecture it is hard, that there will be no polynomial time algorithm, but there are some people that do think it's a matter of time we will eventually find an efficient algorithm classically, but I don't have an opinion about that. Okay, so we continue. I'd like to say a little bit more about the way that we formalize the notion of efficiency, and in particular I will talk about the quantum setting, because that's what we're most interested in for the sake of this talk. And I don't want to go into too much detail here, but it is fitting that we pick a computational model so that we have a precise notion of what we're talking about here. And I'm going to be focusing on quantum circuits. This is the most commonly used model for quantum algorithms, analyzing quantum algorithms. And there are various ways that you can formalize this model, and perhaps the most general one is to say something like this. You have a bunch of qubits, so over here x1, x2, x3, these represent qubits, and we've given names to these qubits, and we feed them into a bunch of operations here, which are arbitrary quantum channels that will map some number of qubits to some other number of qubits. And we just string them together in whatever fashion we like. This is just a cartoon. I don't have anything in mind when I draw these boxes here, but you could imagine that there was quantum channels inside of these boxes. And at the end of the day, we have some outputs, y1 and y2, and that represents the result of the computation. And perhaps if you wanted a classical outcome to this computation, you would just measure these two qubits that came out in standard basis. And the way that we count the number of operations is to just count the number of gates that we use, the number of channels. And that represents the running time of the algorithm. Of course, if you had something in mind, you could just imagine that that entire computation is one channel and the cost would be one, but naturally we don't allow this. We pick a collection of channels or gates that we view as representing unit operations and we count those. Ordinarily, we would just allow things that would involve one or two qubits, maybe three qubits. If we wanted to do something more interesting, we would have to figure out a way to network them together. You notice here that there are no cycles allowed. You can't have any sort of feedback loops. So you can really imagine time is going from left to right here. And these represent the steps that you're doing along the way on these different qubits. Pardon?
Like, what about a for loop?
If you want to, okay, so the question is, what about a for loop? And the answer is, if you want to represent any loop, you have to represent it explicitly. You have to actually unroll the loop and have one, you know, having the gates be laid out.
So different circuit, like if you do a 10-digit prime or a 100-digit prime,
it
would be two different circuits.
The question is, if you have different size inputs, you need different circuits. The answer is yes. You imagine that you have one circuit for every possible length of an input. So if we're interested in factoring a 1,000-bit number, we need to have a special circuit that's ready for 1,000 bits. And actually, now I'm going to say something along those lines precisely. So let's imagine that we have some computational problem of interest. This can be made very abstract in general. And let's suppose that that computational problem is represented by a family of functions, one function for each possible input length. So fn is the function you would like to compute if your input length is n. And let's just imagine that that computational problem is represented as a function from n bits to m bits. And m could perhaps be a function of n. It could just be a single bit if you just wanted to compute a decision problem. It doesn't matter. You can do this however you like. We will say that we have an efficient quantum algorithm for this problem if there is a collection of quantum circuits, and they should have a couple of properties. One property is that the circuit should approximately do what it is that you want it to do. So if you had some particular input of interest, you take the appropriate circuit that's ready for the number of inputs that matches the length of the input. You feed in that input as a quantum state, a standard basis state, where you've initialized all of the input qubits to match the input. You run it, and then let's just say that you measure the output in the standard basis and you get some value that should be a bunch of bits, a bunch of classical bits. And you would like the output to equal the value of the function, the thing you're trying to compute, with high probability. We don't ask that it's perfect. If you have a 1% chance of getting the wrong answer, we accept that, because it's just a more practical and robust model if we allow a probability to make an error. So we're really just looking for very, very good statistical evidence concerning the outcome of our problem. Secondly, in order to be considered efficient, we should have that the size of the circuit is not too big. And what we will say is that the size of the circuit, the number of gates that it uses, should be no more than big O of n to the power c, where c is some fixed constant number, 2, 3, a million, whatever it is. It doesn't matter as long as it's fixed and it doesn't grow as n grows. In other words, the circuit qn has size that's polynomial in n. So we use this notion of equating efficiency with polynomial size or polynomial time in the setting of an algorithm as a simplification. It should be understood that nobody in the world thinks that an n to the 1 billion algorithm is an efficient algorithm, but it is a polynomial time algorithm. And the reason that we do this is because we're just trying to put the problem into the right scope. We're trying to somehow understand the difference between polynomial time and exponential time. Exponential time is probably some sort of brute force, exhaustive search of some kind. A polynomial time algorithm, somehow, even if it's an n to the 1 billion algorithm, it must be doing something very clever because it's avoiding this kind of exhaustive search. In practice, you don't have n to the 1 billion algorithms. What typically happens when somebody discovers a new algorithm, that's a new polynomial time algorithm, the first polynomial time algorithm for some problem, perhaps the constant here is very bad. Maybe it's 12, maybe it's 25. And then there'll be a lot of excitement because somebody came up with a polynomial time algorithm for whatever this problem was. The algorithm designers will come in with their fancy data structures and they will start optimizing the thing and the exponent will drop down further, further. And eventually, maybe you're lucky and you have an n to the 3 algorithm or n to the 2. Some people are not even happy at n to the 2. If the input size a huge database, then people really want a linear algorithm. Maybe they're grumbling if it's an n log n algorithm. Maybe they're happy with n log n. Anyway, the point is that polynomial time is a simplification, but it's just important to appreciate that we're talking about the distinction between something that's clever, avoiding an exhaustive search, versus some sort of brute force exhaustive search where we don't really have a way to exploit the structure of the problem other than just searching through some vast search space. So the algorithm that I gave you from the in the beginning was an example of a brute force search. I'm just looking for a prime factor, and it's really naive. Is there a question? Yes. So the question is, do I mean here that you act this circuit on this input, and with high probability you have the correct answer, and with some small probability you have some possible other answers? The answer is yes, that's what I mean. So you have a problem you're interested in, you would like to have the answer. We are happy if you get the answer with probability 99%. And the reason is that we don't care if it's 99% or if it's 60%. The reason is if you have such an algorithm, and even if it works with probability 60%, all you need to do is run that algorithm 100 times and look at the most commonly appearing outcome, and you'll increase your probability. What it means is you're able to gather useful statistical evidence concerning the answer. And when you're able to do that and you just run the experiment multiple times, you will gain confidence that it's the correct answer. Okay, so the question is, do we have to relate this to number two? And the answer is no. As long as, let's say that we have a 50.001% chance of seeing the right answer. And we have a polynomial time algorithm that does that. My claim is that you can increase the confidence to 99% or 99.9999%, and you don't need to go outside of the polynomial size, because you just need to take the algorithm you had, you need to run it many times and do some statistical evidence, and you will gain confidence very, very quickly as a result of some quantitative form of the law of large numbers. You will see the right answer, and your size won't grow very much. You don't need to run very many times before you have overwhelming confidence that you're right. Okay. I should mention here, and I don't want to say very much about this, I am lying a little bit here. I'm sweeping some details under the rug. You actually would want a little bit more from these circuits, not just that they're polynomial size, but it should be possible for some classical algorithm to give you the description of the nth circuit in time that's polynomial n. We don't want to somehow encode some very, very difficult computational information of some kind into the description of the circuit. But for the sake of this talk, we can ignore that. I just want to point out that you actually, in reality, you do want a little bit more. I mean, probably what this thing represents in reality is that you have a bunch of qubits, they're set up in the laboratory, you have a classical computer that's running your experiment, it's deciding what sort of operations you can apply in some sequence, and then you do this. Naturally, you would want the classical computer to be able to actually control the thing in order to get the operations in the right order. Another question. Yes. Okay, so the question is, sometimes you would have an algorithm and what it's doing would depend on something that happened previously. You may want to terminate a for loop depending on a certain condition happening. How would you sort of unroll this and turn this into a big circuit? The answer is that this model does not allow you to condition anything on the intermediate results. You really just need to lay out the entire circuit beforehand. And the answer is that if you wanted to do something like that where you would control something that was happening inside based on some result, you would need to embed that into the description of the circuit itself. And it is possible to do that. Because imagine you had a loop and you knew, for example, how many iterations it would run in the worst case. You could somehow cook it up so that it would just do a bunch of no-ops for a while at the end of the loop, something like that. Maybe it's a little bit of an argument to show that this is true, but this model does not allow you to, vary the circuit depending on the previous results. And my claim is that that's not a computational restriction that is significant. But you need to go through a little bit of an argument to actually convince yourself that that's true.
But in the world of quantum algorithms, are
Okay, so the question is, in the world of quantum algorithms, is this something that's possible? I mean, the reality is we don't really have very large quantum computers working. You know, this is a computational model that's set up to be some sort of a balance of being useful and being able to easy to analyze. Now imagine that you actually were able to build a quantum computer that was large and it was doing something interesting, and you chose to at some point perform a measurement and use that measurement to control the classical process that was doing something else. Yes, by all means you would do this, and you would probably also try to unload as much work from the quantum part as you could, do lots of classical pre-processing, lots of classical post-processing, do whatever you can to make the efficiency better, and it wouldn't necessarily fit directly into this model, but certainly you would find that polynomial time in either model would be the same. So there is something about the model that is a mathematical simplification, because we would like to be able to analyze things and not have to go through all the work of dealing with special cases like this in the mathematical analysis. Okay, so when we talk about quantum algorithms, we typically restrict our attention to unitary gates. We don't allow arbitrary quantum channels as gates. And the reason for that is that there is no algorithmic advantage to using general quantum channels. We want to make our lives simple and just talk about unitary operations. And it's not too difficult to argue that that doesn't cause any loss of generality. So here's an example of a gate set that is very commonly used. The first gate over here is called a Toffoli gate. And what a Toffoli gate is basically a way of doing an AND gate in a reversible fashion. So you have two inputs, A and B, and I assume these are in a standard basis. There are zeros or ones, and you want to compute their AND. And so what this gate does is it takes the AND. I'm just writing A and B juxtaposed like this to refer to the AND. And it XORs it onto whatever you put in the bottom qubit here, and A and B come out untouched. So this is a reversible gate, and so if you want to write it down as a unitary matrix, you can do that. A Hadamard gate is a very commonly used gate. It just takes either 0 or 1, and it maps it to either 0 plus 1 or 0 minus 1, depending on whether you started with a 0 or a 1. And the last example is a phase gate. And I should mention, I'm going through all these in detail, but it doesn't really matter all that much. You can choose different sets of gates. But anyway, this one will take either 0 or 1, and it'll map it to either just a 0 or to an I times 1, so somehow getting you into the complex domain. So this is an example of a so-called universal gate set. If you have this gate set and you have any quantum, let's start with unitaries. If you have any unitary operation whatsoever, you can approximate it closely with this gate set. This is a topological statement, essentially, that if you have a particular unitary in mind and you would like to approximate it with gates from this set, you can approach it arbitrarily closely. And I'm assuming here, I should mention that we are assuming the availability of some extra zero qubits to start out with that we can use as workspace that we will just throw away at the end, or we will demand that they've returned back to their zero state. There are other universal gate sets. This is just a good one because it's easy to talk about. Perhaps physically you would prefer to have a gate set that would only involve one qubit and two qubit gates, just because it's very difficult to make three qubits interact with one another at the same time. But there are gate sets for which that is the case. But this is a particularly good one because having this Toffoli gate just makes life simple when you want to try to implement other gates. So first let me just argue very quickly, and Patrick has done most of the work yesterday, that we gain no advantage by using non-unitary operations, by using general quantum channels. And the reason is as follows. Imagine that you had a quantum channel and it looked like this. It took n qubits to m qubits. Well, using the Steinspring representation, we know that it is possible to implement that channel by having some unitary acting on more qubits. We put in a bunch of zeros in the beginning here. We run the unitary. We take the first m of them as our output, matching this up here. We throw the rest in the trash, and we will get the channel that we started with. It's always possible to do this, and you never need more than this number of qubits. The easiest way to remember this is that the dimension of the trash has to be equal to the product of the dimensions of the input and the output. And then so you just sort of figure out what is the number, the right number of inputs to match the number of outputs you need here to equal the product of the input and output dimensions. I think that question came up yesterday. So if we had some particular channel that we thought was going to be useful in an algorithmic situation, we can just implement it as a unitary. We're assuming the existence of these zero qubits that we can just take. We take them out of the refrigerator. We plug them into our algorithm. We can throw things in the trash when we're done, and we've implemented our channel, and we've just used the unitary. So from now on, there's no point in talking about anything that's not unitary in the context of this talk, because there's just no algorithmic advantage. It'll make our lives simpler to just talk about unitary operations and pure states. Okay, so let me very quickly mention that it is possible to simulate any classical Boolean circuit with a quantum circuit. This is not very impressive, but certainly it's important to know that this is true, and it actually turns out to be an important part of many quantum algorithms where something has to happen in the middle, and that's a classical thing that's happening. You need to know that it's actually possible to do this. So let's just note that very quickly. And one way to do that is to use the fact that AND gates and NOT gates, along with a fan-out operation where you can take one bit and split it into two, these operations are universal for classical computation. If you have these operations, then you can implement any Boolean function with a circuit. And one way to do that is to use the Toffoli gate to make an AND gate. This is straightforward. You put a zero into the bottom qubit here, and then you just throw A and B when you're done, and you'll get the AND of A and B fan out. In other words, I want to copy this thing and feed it into perhaps two other gates. That can easily be done again with a Toffoli gate if you just initialize it in this way. A NOT gate, if you want to, you can implement it with Hadamards and phase gates. You might also just assume a NOT gate is part of your gate set. That's not really causing any difficulties to just assume you also have a NOT gate. So we have these things. We can easily simulate any classical Boolean circuit. And what we would do is we would just take the classical Boolean circuit and we would go one gate at a time and perform these substitutions that I just mentioned. And if you were to do that, you think about what would happen. Imagine we had this classical Boolean circuit. Let's say it has T gates, has some number of inputs and some number of outputs. Go gate by gate, one at a time, doing these substitutions. And we would end up with a unitary circuit. We haven't even used the Hadamard. We've just used, well, I guess we used the Hadamard for the NOT gate. But there's nothing really quantum going on here. It's all just reversible computations. We would need a bunch of zero qubits to come in that are being used to implement these gates along the way that we're feeding in sometimes to our Toffoli gates. We have our inputs. And we've not increased the size of this circuit very much, right? Because in fact, the NOT gates turned into four gates, according to what I had in the previous slide. The AND gates, they still are one gate. So you've at most increased the size of your circuit by a constant factor. So it's going to be big O of T gates. We will have the input, the output coming out over here. And then we also, if we account for all the outputs that we, in the previous slide, left inside of the boxes, like over here and over here, we'll have some extra outputs that come out here. We don't care about those. In the previous slide, they were just inside of the boxes and we didn't worry about them. But if we're thinking about this as a unitary circuit, they are coming out here. And we've labeled them G1 through GK because they represent garbage. They're things that are byproducts of the computation and they're not useful. And in fact, they're not only not useful, but they're actually detrimental to a quantum algorithm. Typically, when we're trying to implement some quantum algorithm, we're probably trying to set up some sort of interesting interference patterns that are happening among different possible computational paths. And if we have these garbage qubits kicking around, they're probably going to mess things up. It's almost like as if measurements were taking place and disturbing the computation, and the garbage somehow represented the result of the measurement. Technically, maybe that's not exactly what's happening, but you can think of it as being an analogous thing. Somehow these garbage qubits are disturbing the way things are working. But fortunately, you can get rid of the garbage, and you can do that in a very clever way that works like this. And this goes back to the 1970s, and Charlie Bennett was the person who discovered this. So what you do is you start out with the unitary implementation from the previous slide, where you have the output written down here, and then you have all the garbage in this second region here. And now you imagine that you will just take a bunch of new inputs here, it can be anything at all, and you just sort of, bit by bit, you take the XOR from the answer qubit up here, and you XOR it down into this register here. And then you just run the circuit in reverse, because it was unitary, and all those quantum gates, they have an inverse. And in fact, they are their own inverse, except for the phase, which you need to apply three times to give it its inverse. So you can very easily just run them in reverse and do their inverse operation. And if you think about what happens here, you will necessarily go back to the state where you had the input here. All these qubits are set back to their initial zero state, but you've managed to compute the answer and XOR it onto these qubits down here. So this is great because this allows us to take any classical algorithm. We're roughly going to double the size of the circuit, and we're able to implement a unitary version of that circuit where we have to keep a copy of our input around, but we're able to compute the output and XOR it onto some other bunch of qubits. And if you wanted, you could set these all to be zeros so that you would just have your answer written down in the bottom. So this is kind of a very useful general primitive that you can always take a classical computation, turn it into a unitary one, use it inside of a quantum algorithm, and be guaranteed that it works in the way that's described in this picture. Okay, so the question is, paraphrasing, tell me if I'm correct, that in a sense, this copy of the input represents a different type of garbage. And that is true to some extent, but you are right that we know what it is, and we can take advantage of that. It is the case that there are some situations where you just wish that you could have a quantum algorithm that would do something and it would not have this sitting there. That is the case, that it is a limitation in some cases. But it's good enough to do a lot of things.
So somehow decoherence is, the issue is that the garbage might decohere what you're trying to do.
Okay, so the question is the issue that the garbage may decohere what we're doing. Well, I would say just somehow I would say differently, the garbage is spoiling the interference patterns that would make the quantum algorithm work. You know, somehow there's, presumably the quantum algorithm is working because there are all these different possible states of these qubits going along, and they can take all, you can think of them as taking all these different paths. And then at the end of the day, you know, there are some possibilities that represent the correct answer and some that represent the incorrect answer. You would like constructive interference to make the correct answer appear, and destructive interference makes the wrong answer not appear. And if you had these garbage qubits around, they're not on this slide, but the previous one, they would certainly spoil that that kind of pattern for the quantum algorithms we know of. And you really can think of those things as being like, okay, so imagine that the garbage was there, you never used it again, you let it sitting there. You could imagine that the environment would come along and just measure that garbage. I mean, you know, if the environment measures the garbage before you're finished with the computation or after, it doesn't matter because you just left them sitting there on the table. You know, so it's as if it's somehow going along the way there is decoherence happening. It's somehow it's analogous. So that's another way of thinking about it. Correct. Because the garbage is going to be dependent on the specifics of what happened along the way, and it's going to somehow be almost like a record of things that happened, and this is bad for quantum algorithms. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so the question is, if you measured these things here, would that have some influence on the outcome? So I should clarify that probably this whole thing here is happening inside of a much larger quantum algorithm. So perhaps after you've done this, you've carried on and done something more. So you would not assume that you have the ability to measure these things. Perhaps measuring these things can also ruin your algorithm. But this is just one piece that can be used as a subroutine inside of another larger algorithm. And if you want to make the whole thing work, you need to be very careful. You need to stitch things together in the right way. So don't assume that you just because these came out here that that's the end of this algorithm and you can just measure them freely. Perhaps there's much more that happens. Maybe this thing, this whole entire slide here, is inside of some much larger process, and this gets implemented many, many times or something like this. We will see some examples as we go along. Yeah. Okay, so the question is to comment on the relationship between the fan-out gate and the no-cloning theorem. And the answer is that this fan-out gate is only copying in the classical, in the standard basis. It takes a 0 to 0, 0. It takes a 1 to 1, 1. That is fine. That's not a violation of the no-cloning theorem. If you put in a 0 plus 1 state, you will get 0, 0 plus 1, 1, as opposed to two copies of a 0 plus 1 state. So it's simply not cloning. This is a classical copy. Copy with respect to the standard basis, not a general copying of qubits. Okay, I should probably try to pick up the pace a little bit, but I think that's all important stuff to start out with. It helps to just set the stage in a way. But I would like to actually talk about some quantum algorithms, so let me move on, and I'm going to talk about two algorithms. I'll start with the very simplest one, perhaps, Deutsch's algorithm. This is from 1985. It's a first example of a computational advantage of quantum over classical computers. It's really a toy problem. It's extremely simple. But it does help to kind of just get into the right mindset. And then I'll talk about something called eigenvalue estimation, which can be viewed as a generalization of what's happening in Deutsch's algorithm. So this is a very, very simple example. You shouldn't expect to be too impressed by this, but it's a very first example, and it's a good place to start. So let us imagine we have the following situation. We have some function, and it's just mapping one bit to one bit. So there's only four possible functions mapping one bit to one bit. And we will assume that we are given a unitary implementation of that function, just like we had in the previous slide, where you have an input to the function A, you get a copy of A coming out, and you have some other bit B, and you XOR the value of the function evaluated at A onto B. So this is a unitary operation. And everything I've written down here is just whenever I'm using lowercase letters like A, B, C, I'm talking about standard basis states, just zeros and ones. And your goal is to try to figure out which of the following two categories the function f belongs to. The first possibility is that it is a constant function. It is either always zero or it is always one, or it's not. And the other possibility is something we can call a balanced function. So one of the inputs is 0 and one of the inputs is 1 in either order. And you're trying to figure out which category the function belongs to. So we can ask, how many times do you need to use this black box? And you also imagine here you're not allowed to look inside. You're not allowed to try to understand what is the mechanism that's making this box work. It is sealed for you. The only thing you can do is use it inside of a quantum circuit or a classical circuit. And you want to try to figure out your problem. Well, of course, classically, you can do it with two uses of the function, right? You just evaluate the function at 0, you evaluate it at 1, and now you've learned what the function is. You can just look and figure out which category you belong to. But in the quantum setting, we just need one query, one use of the function, and you can solve it. And here's how it works. So we'll start out with two qubits. We have a 0 and a 1. We do a Hadamard transform on both of them, feed the input into our black box. This is the bit here, the qubit, that corresponds to the output of the function. So we will ignore it, which seems a little bit peculiar, but that's the right thing to do. The qubit that comes out here, we will perform a Hadamard transform on it. We will measure it with respect to the standard basis, and we will look at the outcome. We will see either a 0 or a 1, and depending upon what we see, we will make an answer. Okay, so let's see why this works. And the way we can do this is we can just analyze the states of this algorithm as time goes on. So right here we start out, we had a 0 and a 1. We performed a Hadamard transform on both of them, and so we would end up with a state that looks like this. And I'm following this same convention that we saw yesterday, that we just sort of don't bother writing the tensor product, because when we have a bunch of kets like this and we put them together, we just assume it's the tensor product. Then we perform our function, or our apply our black box, and something interesting happens here. So we think about, what does this thing do? Remember that it will evaluate the function on whatever input you put it here, and it will XOR that value onto the bottom qubit. But what we had was, we had a 0 minus 1. So if we were to XOR a 0 onto a 0 minus 1, nothing at all happens. Of course, XORing 0 onto something does nothing at all. If we XOR a 1, that just flips 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. But because we had a 0 minus 1, what we're going to get is a 1 minus 0. But that's the same thing as a negative 1 times 0 minus 1. So by either XORing a 0 or a 1 onto this, what happens is that you either get a plus 1 or a minus 1. And because this is a tensor product, you might as well associate that with whatever was going on here. So effectively, if you had a 0, you evaluated the function, you get a minus 1 coming out if f of 0 is equal to 1, or just a plus 1 if f of 0 equals 1. And likewise here, sometimes this is called the phase kickback. You XORed something onto this register, but all it did was either inject a plus 1 or minus 1 phase into the state of the entire thing. And so you can kind of just associate that with whatever you started with over here. And you know, if you like, just sort of write it all out and simplify and see that you actually do get this if it's not quite clear. And that also explains at this point why we might as well throw away this bottom qubit. It's in the state 0 minus 1. It's unentangled with the other thing. It's not giving us any information at all. The last step, we perform this Hadamard transform. And if you expand it all out and you collect the terms in the right way, then you will see that you get a state that looks like this. And now what you see here is that this coefficient here or this coefficient here, one of the two will always be equal to 0, depending on whether the function is a constant function or a balanced function. So when you measure, you'll be guaranteed to see the correct outcome. And that is how Deutsch's algorithm works. It's extremely simple. And you see that you have this computational advantage that you're able to figure this out by using just one function evaluation rather than two. It may not seem like that's very impressive, but that's just a start. It's a toy problem, and it shows us one way to use quantum information to an advantage in a computational setting. Question? Okay, so the question is going back a few slides, I think. It's to say, how do you define the quantum complexity of a circuit? We're just counting the number of gates. If you think about each gate as representing something that's done with one unit of time, it's the same thing as asking how much time, assuming you're doing the gates one at a time in the right order or in an order that works. So the size of the circuit is roughly the same, or you can think of it as being the same as the number of steps that needs to be performed. Okay, so next I'm going to talk about, I guess, a kind of generalization of Deutsch's algorithm, although calling it a generalization is probably not quite right. It's quite a bit more sophisticated, but there are common elements to it, and that is this technique of phase estimation or eigenvalue estimation. And this is an important thing that's done in several different quantum algorithms, and it's a key step in Shor's algorithm for factoring integers. So let me explain how this works. So let us first suppose that we start with some unitary circuit on n qubits, and we don't necessarily care how this thing is constructed. We just will assume that it's given to us, and we are going to use it as a quantum circuit. Of course, just thinking of a circuit as a linear operator or linear mapping, it's acting on a space of dimension capital N, which is 2 to the little n. N is the number of qubits. And because it's unitary, we can apply the spectral theorem, and we know that there must be a collection of eigenvectors that are orthonormal, and they have corresponding eigenvalues. And because it's unitary, all of the eigenvalues will be sitting on the unit circle. So if we want to, we can come up with this basis of eigenvectors, And each corresponding eigenvalue will sit on the unit circle, and I would like to write them in this way, so that each one is e to the 2 times pi times I times some theta. So theta is between 0 and 1. So if you put in one of these eigenvectors into this unitary, what's going to come out is the same eigenvector with this phase multiplied to it, because that's the associated eigenvalue. So the eigenvalue estimation problem, think of it more as a kind of a quantum subroutine that's going to be used inside of a larger algorithm, sort of something that you will want to do along the way as you're trying to solve some other problem, is as follows. You imagine that you have some input. The input is a quantum circuit that implements U, and you imagine that somehow you've gotten your hands on an eigenvector as a quantum state. So where exactly that came from, well, we don't worry about that right now. That's just coming from some other part of some algorithm, perhaps, and this is just a subroutine that we're working on here. We have the circuit, we have the vector as a quantum state, and we are promised that it really is an eigenvector, and what we would like to do is we would like to approximate this value theta that represents the eigenvalue that's associated with that eigenvector. So you would just like to somehow approximate this number between 0 and 1. And naturally, because we're going around the unit circle here, of course, when you think about a close approximation to a number that's, say, close to 0 or 1, you're perfectly happy to have wrapped around. So, you know, something a little bit less than 1 is a very good approximation to something that's a little bit bigger than 0, because we're just working in the circle here. So we're looking for an approximation of theta in that sense. So in general, there's an issue here that regards the precision of the estimate. If you are happy with a low precision approximation of theta, you can always do that. But if you want a high precision estimate of theta, then you need a little bit more than just to be able to implement this U as a quantum circuit. In fact, you need something that looks like this thing here. This is like a controlled version of U. But not only is it controlled, but it's allowing you to do high powers of U. So specifically, the way this thing works, and sometimes this is called a lambda sub m of U gate, sort of like a controlled version of U. You imagine you have m qubits at the top here, and if you put in some classical state that represents an integer written in binary notation, then what this thing will do is it will apply this U this many times to whatever came in the bottom. And then this number of times you were supposed to apply this thing comes out unchanged. So in general, if I was to just give you an arbitrary circuit that implements U, and you would like to implement this thing for a large value of m, that may be very difficult. We don't know how to do that in general. What we will assume for the sake of this phase estimation problem is that somehow we are able to do this. So we are given this controlled version of U that, that will perform the operation that's suggested here. And when it comes time to use this technique in the setting of factoring, we will show that it is possible to implement such a thing. Okay. So let's think about the action that this particular controlled version of U has when we give it an eigenvector and we put in some arbitrary integer on the top. So here's our controlled gate. We put in an eigenvector on the bottom, and we put in some number k on the top written in binary. Just by the definition of the way the thing behaves, what comes out on the top is a copy of k. On the bottom, we've applied k times the unitary u. But we know that psi was an eigenvector, so we're just going to get our eigenvalue applied k times. And because what we have over on this side is a tensor product, there's no reason why we need to associate this scalar with the bottom collection of qubits. I simplified the expression there. We can move that coefficient to the top because this is a tensor product of two things. It doesn't hurt us to just let this scalar float around in a tensor product. And because this thing is linear, if instead you have chosen at the beginning not to evaluate the circuit at just a single value of k, but in fact if you took a uniform state over all the possible choices of k, you would just get the same thing happening over here. Just by linearity, you've just summed over all these different values of k. So in summary, what we have is a transformation that works like this. So if you have this particular eigenvector given in the bottom, and you chose that you wanted to take this particular state here, and I'm always following this convention where the capital letters are representing 2 to the power, which is the little letter. So it was m qubits up here, so capital M is 2 to the little m. Then the action would go like this. You would leave this eigenvector alone, which is natural because it's an eigenvector. You expect it's not changing. But there could be some eigenvalue coming out, but that eigenvalue is being somehow absorbed into this expression, and you have written that all down on the left, and it looks like that. So let's consider, to begin with, a very easy special case. The special case is that the particular quantity that we're trying to approximate looks like an integer divided by 2 to the power m. That won't necessarily be the case in general, but let's just imagine for now that that is the case. So we don't know what theta is. We're trying to find it. We're assuming it takes this form here. So we know that there must be some integer j that's in this range, and we are trying to figure out what it is. From the previous slide, what we have is this situation here. And here I've just plugged in this particular choice of theta into the expression from the previous slide, so it looks like this. And the situation is that this thing over here is very easy to create. All you need to do is just take a bunch of zeros and do Hadamard transform to every single one, and you will get this uniform superposition over all these possibilities. And you end up with this thing over here. And what you want to do is you want to compute what is j given this particular state. Because if you know what j is, then you just divide it by 2 to the m, and you will figure out what is j. So that is the situation under the assumption that our theta took this very special form here. OK, so I've just restated from the previous slide what we're trying to do. Now, of course, if this is to be possible at all, forget about computational efficiency. Just think about whether it's information theoretically possible. If you're able to figure out what is j from this thing here, naturally you assume that these phi sub j's are forming an orthonormal basis. You can't possibly distinguish the different elements of a set like this unless they're all orthogonal. The number is the dimension of the space you're working in, so it has to form a basis. So the first thing we should check is that actually these do form an orthonormal basis of the space, and indeed they do. It's not too hard to just sort of look at these things, take the inner product of any 2 of them, and if you take 2 different ones, take their inner product and just figure out what it looks like, what you're going to be doing is just going to be summing a bunch of points going around the unit circle, and they're going to be uniformly spread somehow around the unit circle, you'll get 0. So what you require is you require some unitary transformation that's going to map this thing here into J. Well, this is the natural way to do it. You want to know what J is, so you apply this unitary transformation. You hope to turn it into this particular state here. Then you can just measure in the standard basis, and you see your answer. So we would like to try to figure out how to build such a unitary. We know that a unitary V exists because these are 2 orthonormal bases, and you're just changing one basis into another. So to say that V applied to this phi sub j is equal to j, it's equivalent to saying that V dagger applied to j is equal to phi sub j. And if you write down the matrix that will do what you want, it looks like this. So here omega is just this principal mth root of unity, and you write these things all down in this pattern here, and you get this unitary operation written as a matrix that you would like to perform that's going to allow you to do this, to figure out what is J. And I think probably many people will look at this matrix and recognize it. It's the matrix that represents the discrete Fourier transform, which appears over and over in different branches of science and has many applications. So this is the thing that we would like to do in order to figure out what is J. We would like to perform as a quantum circuit or as a quantum operation the discrete Fourier transform. When we think of that operation as a quantum operation, we call it the quantum Fourier transform just to make clear that we're talking about a quantum circuit, something that's implementing this thing as a unitary operation. And I will denote it by F sub m, because we can think about this thing for any modulus m, but we have in mind a particular one that is determined by the number of qubits m that we plugged into the top of this circuit. So here's our final algorithm. Again, remember that we're in this special case where we have theta, which is some integer j divided by 2 to the m, and we're trying to figure out what is j. So we start out, we apply Hadamard transforms to all these qubits on the top so that we would have that uniform state from the previous, a couple of slides ago. We had whatever our eigenvector was. We don't know where that came from, but we imagined we had it. And we run it through the circuit. We know that this thing is going to come out unchanged. And if we're going to figure out what is j from whatever was sitting there, we need to apply not exactly the quantum Fourier transform, but the dagger of that. That was the right way of making this thing work. And then we just measure with respect to the standard basis, and we should see our outcome j. And indeed, for this special case that theta is equal to j over 2 to the m, run this algorithm, and you will, with 100% chance, assuming, of course, there's no errors, we're not worrying about errors and uncertainties here, you will see j written in binary, and you will measure that, and you'll get that. Any question about that? Of course, there are still several issues that we need to worry about, but just to make sure that the idea here is clear. So there's two basic issues. One is that you need to figure out how do you actually implement this quantum Fourier transform as a quantum circuit. This is not something that you can automatically do, so you need to be able to build it out of gates. And the second one is that generally theta is not going to have this very special form, so we need to worry about what happens in that case. Well, the first issue is quite simple. You just, you know, let somebody else figure out how to do it. And this is a way that you can implement the quantum Fourier transform as a quantum circuit, and I'm just sort of giving you an example that illustrates how it works. Suppose you wanted to perform this operation where capital M is 32, so we're performing this thing on 5 qubits. What you need to do is first perform it on 4 qubits, so you just have to figure out how to do that. It's just going to recurse and go down and follow the same pattern as you go down. And then you need to somehow get this this qubit involved, and a way to do that is to somehow inject a bunch of phases into this thing, do a Hadamard transform, scramble the bits, and it will work. So you're not expected to stare at that circuit and figure out immediately why it works, but it does work. And it turns out that there is a very, very close connection between the reason that this particular quantum circuit works with the fast Fourier transform. So the fast Fourier transform is an extremely important algorithm that computes the discrete Fourier transform. If you wanted to compute the discrete Fourier transform in the most straightforward way, you would just do matrix multiplication. It would take a number of steps that's roughly the square of the dimension. Fast Fourier transform does it in n log n steps. There is a particular recursive structure of this thing that makes it work. Some people have characterized the fast Fourier transform as the second most important algorithm ever discovered. The first one is, of course, sorting. But here we have a quantum version of that, and it really does mimic the way the classical fast Fourier transform algorithm works. Anyway, you have to sort of just take my word for it, or if you like, try to look these things up and figure out that it really works. But that's the way that you can do this. So now moving on to the second issue, which is takes a little bit more work. In general, we don't have an eigenvalue where theta is going to take this very special form of some integer divided by 2 to the m. You could have anything in there. So let's just imagine that we had some general value of theta, and let's think about what we're going to get. We're not going to change the algorithm. The algorithm will be exactly the same, and what we want to argue is that it will still work with good probability. Okay, so I'm sort of just copying here this expression of the state of the entire thing, actually the state of this top collection of qubits. At the end, if we had some general value of theta, and we've done the quantum Fourier transform, so somehow this quantum Fourier transform is coming into play here because we have this minus j over m expression here, which is the inverse of the quantum Fourier transform. So if we were to measure the outcome of the top here, we would see each particular value of j with a probability that looks like that. And what you want to try to argue is that you are likely to see a value of j, so that j over 2 to the m will give you a pretty good approximation of theta, regardless of what theta was. And I'm going to try to go through that a little bit quickly because I it's a little bit technical, and I have suggested as a couple of the problems for the problem session that you get a little bit more into this and think about why these things work. So I think this is kind of a good starting point for looking at those problems, thinking about the expression that represents the probability of seeing each particular value of j, and just trying to examine a little bit why that should be a good give you a good approximation. But I can at least show you some pictures that suggest that it should work, at least for small values of these different numbers, but the pictures generalize. So let's just imagine that we had a situation where capital M was 32, so we're doing using 5 bits for the top, and we think about different possible values of theta that fall into this range here. So at this point, you can imagine, okay, M is not changing, but theta happens to take this very special form. It's going to be 10 over 32. So we already analyzed that case, and we saw that we would get the correct value with 100% chance. Over here is on the y-axis is the probability to see each particular choice of j. So you will see the right j. All of the other j's, you will see them with probability 0. Now, what happens if you were to move theta a little bit? So imagine you change theta from 80 over 256 to 81 over 256. You look at the probabilities. Well, you see that the probability of getting the perfect solution or the closest one, it drops a little bit. And they've all bumped up a little bit. You can't really see that, but you can see that this one, for example, has jumped up. They've all jumped up a little bit. As you increase theta, you'll see that this peak will shrink, goes down a little bit. The other possibilities crop up a little bit. But you generally have this pattern where you're likely to see results that are somehow pretty tightly concentrated around the right answer. And the guys that are over here, although you may see them with non-zero probability, they're not very likely. Continuing on, the probability is going to drop. Of course, when you're exactly halfway in between, you expect the two outcomes that are closest to be equally likely. And it happens to be the case that when that happens, when you're exactly halfway between two values of j that are equally good approximations, you will always see one of those two outcomes, and the probability will always be at least 4 over pi squared. So probability about 40%, a little bit bigger than 40%, you will be guaranteed to get the best possible j to represent an approximation to your number. So if you took m to be large, that's lots of bits of accuracy. And what this is saying is that even if you take lots and lots of bits of accuracy, you'll be guaranteed to get the absolute best approximation, or one of the two best approximations, always with probability at least 40%. And naturally, if you continue further, it just reverses direction. And so in general, what you should probably do, if you want to get the right answer, is to just run this whole process some number of times, like 10 times maybe, or 100 times. And you just calculate what are the values of j that you're seeing. You always have the eigenvector coming out, so it's ready to be analyzed again. The eigenvector is not disappearing. And what you can do is you can run this thing 10 times, and you just look at the result that appears most frequently, and with very, very high probability, that will be the best m-bit approximation to your theta. Okay. I guess I have about 20 minutes left, and I now would like to tell you how this phase estimation procedure is actually used to factor integers, but I'm happy to pause for any questions, if there are any, about phase estimation. Did I clobber you a little bit with technical details? I mean, it's there are some details there, but the ideas hopefully make some sense. Question. Well, the question is, could you use information gathered from the entire distribution to help you rather than just looking at the best ones? We have to keep in mind here that what we actually get is we get one sample from this distribution, right? So some J appears. You measure, you see a J. And you need to figure out, what do I do with that information that I had? And so what you know is, you know that there was at least a 40% chance that that J was the best one. There might have been some tiny, tiny probability that it was very far away, higher probability that it was a little bit closer, but your goal is to estimate what is theta. So there's nothing better than you can do is to just say, well, I will take this J, I will divide by 2 to the m, and that will be my guess. Because there's just no better guess than that from one sample. Yeah, okay, so if you run it 100 times, you will see, you will then see some more samples. But remember, you're assuming your goal is really to say what is theta, I think your best bet is still going to be just, maybe you're right. Maybe if you started to see some things that were a little bit skewed, you would guess that, okay, probably I'm bigger than this thing. I shouldn't take this value. Maybe I should average them all. Sure, you can do things like that. But a simple analysis is just to say, take the guy that appeared most frequently, and I know that's going to be good to m bits of accuracy. I'm happy with that. And if you wanted to improve that, one way to do it would be to try to do something like this. Another way would just be to add a couple of bits to the procedure and, you know, get an even better approximation. So, I will now explain a little bit about how we actually use phase estimation to factor. If nothing else, I hope people come away from this with the understanding that Shor's algorithm is not something so naive as trying all the possible factors in superposition, something like this, the kind of thing you would read in the, you know, popular press. It doesn't work that way at all. Anyway, here's how it works. So I should just, from the start, mention what is the running time. If you analyze the running time, you'll see that this is an n cubed, log n cubed algorithm for factoring. And if you want to, you can do some improvements and sort of offload some of the work from a quantum computer and make the quantum part be about log n squared. So it is a polynomial time algorithm. It's much more efficient than the number field sieve, asymptotically speaking. Of course, you require a quantum computer to run it. But one way to understand this algorithm is through phase estimation. So we've now seen how phase estimation works. And for the most part, we've seen most of the kind of inner workings of Shor's algorithm. We just need to put it together and make it solve the problem. The way this works is to use an intermediate problem, which is called the order-finding problem, and make use of the phase estimation procedure to solve the order-finding problem and relate this order-finding problem with factoring through a classical reduction. So the order-finding problem looks like this. You're starting with some integer n, and this will be the number that we want to factor. And we're given some other integer a, and we'll assume that it's smaller than n. And we will also assume that the greatest common divisor of A with N is equal to 1. So there's no common factors here. And what your goal is try to figure out what is the smallest positive integer R, such that if you raised A to the power R, you would get 1 after you divided by N and you took the remainder. So whenever I write an equal sign with 3 lines like this, this means a congruence. And the way you can read this is that this thing and this thing have the same remainder when divided by n. So think about this mod n as not being an operation applied to the right-hand side. It's really just an explanation for what this 3 lines mean. Another way of saying it is the left-hand side minus the right-hand side is divisible by n. So there is always a number r that will satisfy that. This is a basic property, basic fact coming from group theory that there will always be such an r. And you want to find the smallest possible one. So the order-finding problem is to compute what is R, given n. And you can hope to factor a number n by being able to solve this order-finding problem in the following way. What you do is you randomly sample some choice of A, and you try to compute its order, and you hope you get lucky and you gain some information about the factors of n. Of course, if you guess some A and you see that the GCD of A with N is not equal to 1, then you, in fact, can't believe how lucky you are because you now have a factor of N. You can just break N into 2 pieces by dividing, and then you can recurse, and you don't even need to do all of this. So you're very lucky if you found an A that had a GCD that was larger than 1. But in general, you probably are likely to get GCD equals 1. You compute the order. this is the step I just mentioned. You compute the order A of R, R of A mod N. And now you hope you're lucky. And if you are lucky, this order will be even. It could be odd, but you're lucky if it's even. And so if it is even, you know that N has to divide this product here, because if I just multiply these two to get things together, we just get A to the power R minus 1. We know that that is divisible by N. And now what you do is you compute the GCD of one of the two. It doesn't really matter, but let's just say we take this one here. Compute the greatest common divisor with N. I should mention that computing GCDs is very, very easy. You can use Euclid's algorithm to do that, and you require a number of steps, which is roughly the same as multiplying two numbers together. If you're lucky, you will see some non-trivial factor, and then you can again break N into pieces and then recurse and keep going until you have prime numbers. Now, you see, the point here is why this is likely to work, or on average should work, is that you know, you go back to the the expression of N as a product of a bunch of primes, and you know that N divides this thing here, this product, and there's some kind of randomness that's involved in this choice of A, and so you sort of imagine that the prime factors that go into N should somehow roughly, fall into these two piles equally likely. So somehow you are likely to get some of the prime factors of N dividing one and some of the prime factors dividing the other, so that you can isolate a part of the factorization of N in this way. If you use elementary number theory, it's not very difficult, but I certainly won't go through it, you can show that if the number is even and it is not a perfect power, then you will be lucky both times and the probability will be at least 1/2. So it is possible that you will be unlucky, but with probability 1/2, you will be lucky. And so you will actually manage to find a non-trivial factor. So you've run this thing. If you're unlucky, you say, fine, and do it again. If you're lucky, then you've got a non-trivial factorization of N. You break N into pieces, and then you just recurse, and you keep going until you have prime factors. Of course, if N is even, it doesn't work. But we can all find a prime factor of an even number, I'm pretty sure. And it also doesn't work if you have a prime power, and that sort of goes back to this example from the beginning of the talk. You can easily just do some pre-processing at the beginning to make sure you don't have a prime power. Just compute the square root, the third root, the fourth root. You don't need to go through very many roots before you ran out of possibilities. You just test them all to make sure you're not in that category. Okay. Now we would like to figure out how we can solve this order-finding problem using phase estimation. I'm going through this a bit quickly because there's not too much time left, and hopefully I'm just giving you the sense of how it works. If all the details aren't falling into place, it's because it deserves a little bit more time than I'm giving it, but hopefully I can just give the flavor of how it's working. So what we will do is we will define some unitary operation, which is essentially just going to be multiplying by some fixed A modulo N. So this is a unitary because multiplication is it's going to be a reversible. You just multiply by A inverse. That's why we need the GCD to be 1 with N, so that there is an inverse, and it is unitary. I need the input here to be less than N, so it has to be in this range in order for this all to make sense. So let's just agree that we do nothing in the case that it's not in that range. And that's just a special case that's meant to make sure this thing is unitary. We'll never actually apply it in those cases. We can ask, what are the eigenvectors of this operation? We're going to be looking at the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors because we're connecting it with phase estimation. We can try to figure out what they are. Well, there are a lot of them, and we don't care about a lot of them, but some of them we care about. Here's one example of an eigenvector. So it's just a uniform quantum state over A to the power 0, A to the power 1, A to the power 2, and so on, going all the way up to A to the power R minus 1. And of course, if I go one further and I have A to the power R, I would go back to 1 here. So now you think about what happens if you take a state that looks like this and you perform this multiplication operator on it. So you're just going to be multiplying each of these things by A, taking the remainder mod N. So 1 will go to A will go to A squared, and so on. A to the power R minus 1 will go back to 1. So nothing at all has happened. This is an eigenvector of this operation. The eigenvalue is 1. It's kind of like, you know, multiplying by A is kind of like stirring it a little bit, but the whole thing was already stirred to begin with, so nothing happened. Here's another example, and in this case, the eigenvector is, or the eigenvalue, I should say, is omega, this principal Rth root of unity. It looks almost exactly the same as the one up here, but we imagine that we've just put a coefficient in front of each of these things, which is omega to the minus one times the power that we have inside of the ket here. Excuse me. So what's happening here, you have an eigenvector with eigen, this is the eigenvalue. Think about what happens if you had this state here, you multiply by A, it goes here, but it's missing the coefficient here. And likewise, you go here, we have a one less power than we should, continuing around like this, and you see that if you, what you get is you basically get an eigenvalue of omega popping out if you do this operation, which just corrects for the shifting of this of these expressions. So let us just imagine that somehow we were able to get our hands on that particular eigenvector of this operation. If we could do that, then it would be great. We would figure out how to compute the order in the following way. We would just take that eigenvector, plug it into our exact same procedure from before. And we know that the associated eigenvalue looks like this. So it's e to the 2 pi I times theta, where theta is 1 over r. The thing we're trying to find is r. And so now we do the approximation. We get some j, and j over 2 to the m is roughly equal to 1 over r. And if I give you an approximation to 1 over r and I ask you what is r, of course you can compute r. You just take the reciprocal, throw away any fractional part. Now I guess you have to think a little bit about what is the precision that you actually need in order to figure out what is r. If I give you an approximation to 1 over r, and you're going to compute the reciprocal. And basically what you need to make sure is that you will not be confused between 1 over r and the closest other fraction, which is 1 over r plus 1, meaning closest fraction, which is 1 over some integer. And that'll tell you like how many bits of precision you need to make sure this is going to work. If you just make sure you have enough precision, and this is the number of bits of precision you need, roughly. Take m to be about twice the length of the number n written in binary. That'll give you enough so that you will be sure to get the right approximation. Then you can recover what is r. There's a couple of issues that still need to be resolved. First of all, remember that it's not good enough to have this multiplication thing. We actually needed this special controlled version where we could have the control have a number of bits of precision that was high enough to make this thing work here. So this m on the top here really is corresponding very directly to the precision that we need in this phase estimation procedure. And the second thing is that you don't actually know how to get your hands on this particular eigenvector. The first issue is very easy, and I'll just kind of go through this very quickly. If you think about the entire operation that you need, it looks like this. This is something called modular exponentiation. It's known how you can implement this thing efficiently. What you don't do is you don't compute a to the power k and then multiply it by to x and then take the remainder mod n, because a to the power k could be extremely large because k can be large. What you should do instead is you should just repeatedly square that number or square that number and multiply in a copy of a, each time taking the remainder mod n going along. This is a technique called repeated squaring, so you make sure your intermediate results are not too big. And the running time looks like this. And this is the dominant term in Shor's algorithm, or one of the two. It's a bigger problem to worry about this eigenvector. And the reality is that we actually don't know how to construct that thing. I should say we do know how to construct that thing, but the way to do that would be to solve the order-finding problem and work in reverse. So we need a different solution. We can't just get our hands on this eigenvector. So what we're going to do instead is something different, and I will have to go quickly through this, but I'll give you the basic idea. You can imagine defining analogous eigenvectors to the ones we had before. We had 0 and 1 before, but now we can just imagine letting k range over all these possibilities between 0 and r minus 1, thinking about an associated eigenvector, which is very similar to the eigenvalue will be omega to the power k. And what we can observe is that if we simply take this very, very simple quantum state, which is just the classical state representing 1 written in binary, it is a uniform linear combination of all of these eigenvectors. And so what we can do is instead of even bothering to try to come up with an eigenvector, we'll just plug in this one classical state here and run this thing. We'll use the fact that this one is a linear combination of all these different eigenvectors. We run the procedure, and what we will get is we will get an approximation not to 1 over r, but to k over r for whatever k, for a random choice of k, because each of the k's would be equally likely to appear. We'll get one of those things selected uniformly at random, and we will hope to figure out what is r based on our estimate of k over the power r. Unfortunately, we don't know what k is. We're going to get an approximation to k over r for some random choice of k, and we're going to try to figure out what is r from that random sample. But it turns out that there is a way to do this. It's not quite so simple as just taking the reciprocal as we had before. Now we need to perform something a little bit more complicated, but there is an algorithm that will do this. It's called the continued fraction algorithm. And what the continued fraction algorithm will do is if you give it some real number, it will give you successively better fractional approximations to that number. So you figured out some j that was going to be approximation to k over r. You don't know what k is, but you run this continued fraction algorithm, and you can get a pretty good approximation to k over r. Of course, if there are common factors between k and r, you're not going to see those. You're just getting an approximation to the number. You don't see the k and r. You see the ratio. But it's all not a problem. What you will certainly get is you will approximate some t, which is a divisor of r. You can just run this a handful of times, and I believe, in fact, you only need to run it 2 times. You take the least common multiple of the r, the denominators you see, you are very, very likely to recover all of r. And now you have the order, and everything works. And in summary, I think I have enough time to flash up the summary of the algorithm. This is the entire algorithm. You want to factor n. You apply the following algorithm, and you just keep on doing it until you're tired. You choose some a at random. You compute the GCD with n. If you see something that's bigger than 1, then you're extremely happy. You found a factor of n. Otherwise, you continue on. Compute the order. You do that using the eigenvalue estimation procedure. You get a random value of k over r for some random k. You use the continued fraction algorithm. You get some non-trivial divisor of r. You do this a few times. You take the least common multiple. You recover r. And then you hope that r was even. And then you hope that the GCD of a to the power r over 2 minus 1 with n is equal to something non-zero. Maybe you were unlucky, but that's OK. You just go back and you do it all again. You will be lucky with probability at least a half. And so you can kind of just think about how many times do I have to run this before I get a factor of n. You're very likely to get a factor of n after just a few iterations of it. You've got a factor of n, split n into 2 pieces, go back to the drawing board, do it again. Split n, keep going until you get a bunch of primes. And along the way, if you want to, you can test that you really have primes. There's efficient algorithms that will test primality. And that is it. That is the way Shor's algorithm works. And that is the end of the talk. I want to mention a couple of places where you can go to find more information on more sophisticated quantum algorithms. There's a couple of very nice surveys. They're getting a little bit old. They're from 2008, but they contain lots of information on algorithms that, in many cases, build on Shor's algorithm, use similar techniques, and solve a number of problems. These are surveys that are mostly focused on quantum algorithms for problems for which there are no efficient classical algorithms known. There's also this entire other field of query complexity, which looks at different sorts of variants of this Deutsch's problem, where you have some sort of black box and you're trying to figure out something about it. There's that's a very, very active area of research to understand this sort of black box query complexity of quantum versus classical algorithms. So there's quite a lot to read about. That is the end of the lecture. Okay, so the question is, how do you decide what your fundamental quantum gates are? You can make any decision you want, right? And you'll have one model or another model depending on what you have. You would like to make a choice which somehow represents what you actually do in reality, in practice. So, you know, assuming that you can do some particular set of gates and hoping that people in laboratories can implement those things is one possible way to go about it. So, okay, so the question is, if you're using this to count efficiency, basically the notion of efficiency should be very highly dependent upon the choice of the gates is what you're worried about. And the answer is that if you choose any universal gate set, it isn't going to make any difference because you would be able to approximate gates from one collection by gates from another collection. So as long as you had a universal gate set, and people make different choices depending upon techniques that come up, methods for doing these things. I haven't talked at all about error correction and fault tolerance. You would presumably also want a gate set which you could use to reduce inaccuracies and noise. So this could inform your choice of a gate set. You know, for example, the gate set that I showed you, which was, you know, Toffoli gate, Hadamard, phase gates, this is a very, very common set. You will see people choosing different ones, and it would be sort of, you know, an exercise or perhaps a paper where somebody would show the equivalence of the two. You could take one, turn it into the other one, and this would not have any dependence at all on a quantum algorithm that was using them because these are just fixed size quantum gates. Some bad choices would be gate sets where, for example, the entries that appear in the matrices that describe those gates would be very, very complicated, complex numbers. For example, you wouldn't want to have some number in there that was extremely difficult to compute. Obviously, you wouldn't want to allow gate sets where the sizes of the gates were large because it would somehow just not represent this notion of a fundamental operation. It's not a question of whatever A you choose. If you choose A uniformly, and as long as N is not even and it is not a prime power, guaranteed with probability at least 50%, you will have chosen an A such that the order of A is even. And not only that, but you will also get a prime factor when you do this greatest common divisor. Yes. Yes, that is correct, and it's actually not too hard to see that should be the case. I mean, you know, you're based for some group theoretic reason. I mean, every guy that's a mod n should be expressible, and you know, as some generator to some power, and it's going to be even or odd, and it's going to be even half the time, that kind of thing. But there's more to it to say that you will also be lucky in the GCD step. So, you know, you get both of those things with probability at least a half, so it's even stronger. Okay, so the question is, instead of randomly choosing A, if you just started at the beginning and you went through the A's sequentially, would that affect the running time? You have to worry about, in this case, a bad choice of N, which might potentially have a large string of A's in the beginning that was not good. And I would guess that it would be very difficult to prove that you would get a good running time. You might be able to assume the generalized Riemann hypothesis and show that there is no bad n that would have more than, say, log squared a, you know, bad a's in the beginning or something like that. But if you want an unconditional result, definitely just randomly choosing a is the way to go. I don't know for a fact that that's true, but I would be willing to guess that probably generalized Riemann hypothesis would tell you something about the distribution of bad a's and whether you could have long strings of bad a's in the beginning. Oh yeah, that's absolutely possible. It's also possible to flip a coin 1,000 times and get heads every time. I mean, we are talking about similar likelihood of events.